adults are having a conversation about it, but often we leave students out of those conversations. And I think if we are more intentionally allowing students to lead some of those conversations, we would have more inclusive spaces in K-12 and more opportunities. Some of these moments that are educational, and they happen by being youth-led.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners, and really all students, achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis. We have a repeat guest on Highest Aspirations today. I first talked with Dr. Joanna Drebbe and some of her students back in March of 2022. We discussed the challenges that U.S.-born children of immigrants face in school, family, and social environments. The two episodes we did were really eye-opening and quite poignant for me, as it was also to many of our listeners. Joanna and one of the students we profiled in the series, Falmari Rojas Barrios, will be joining us at our upcoming Impact Conference to talk more about this topic. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But we also decided to put this episode together around some of the other work that Joanna and her team are doing at the University of Albany. Dr. Eric Macias has also been an integral part of this work, and he joins us in this interview to make connections between what they are doing with undergraduate students and how we might be able to apply some of their learnings to K-12 settings as well, something that we think is really important. We'll dig into an impactful, independent study experience they designed at the University of Albany to facilitate meaningful discussions among undergraduate students on immigration, the strategies they used to create a conducive environment for sharing personal migration stories, how K-12 educators can create inclusive and supportive environments for students to share their immigration experiences, and much more. Before we get into our conversation with Joanna and Eric, I want to let everybody know that registration is now open for Elevation Impact 2023. That is a free virtual conference with 9 sessions over the course of 3 days, featuring some of the premier experts in multilingual education. So mark your calendars for December 4th, 5th, and 7th. You can learn more about Impact by visiting our website at elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity, or you can go ahead and register for the event and learn more on our Zoom registration page. That link is bit.ly/ELLImpact2023. No caps in that bit.ly link. We'll also post a link on the show notes as well as the accompanying blog post for this episode. As always, thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations, and please enjoy our conversation with Dr. Joanna Drebbe and Dr. Eric Macias. Dr. Joanna Drebbe and Dr. Eric Macias, thank you so much for joining us on Highest Aspirations.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us. It's great to be back.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us. This is a great opportunity.
For sure. And Joanna, you've been on before. We did a great series about English learners born in the United States and their experience. We were just talking about one of your students. So shout out to Falmari, who was on before, if she's listening, and she's going to be doing some more work with us, which is awesome. That was one of my favorite experiences on the podcast. And I know I speak for a lot of us at Elevation who were involved in kind of putting that series together. So we're so excited to have you back and bring in Eric to talk about some of the work that he's doing. This is a result of conversations that we've been having about our Impact virtual conference, which is coming up here in just a couple weeks. And you will be joining us for that with Falmari as well, which is exciting. But we really wanted to put something out before then and kind of get into this work that you're doing with Eric. So let me kind of like start off by just being very general. So let's start by discussing the design and the structure of this independent study experience that you've developed for undergraduate students to discuss immigration. And let me just say also that we're going to talk a lot about undergraduate students here, but we'll come back and we'll kind of connect it to K-12. So if you're listening right now and you're thinking, well, I don't teach undergrads, we're going to bring this back. Just wait till the end. So that's important. Anyway, how did you, when you created this, this undergraduate, so first of all, describe it a little bit, this independent study. And how did you make it sort of a conducive environment for students to share these very sometimes personal migration stories and engage in really meaningful discussions?
Yeah, well, I'll start. And Steve, it was really interesting because it started as an experiment. And I had a different graduate student I was working with who had done undergraduate research previously before coming to UAlbany. And we discussed this idea that I was starting interviews for this project, and the interviews were about how young adults who were born in the US had experiences with immigration policies that affected their parents. So that was sort of the broad research idea. And we said, let's try to involve some undergraduates. And she had some experience doing this from an undergraduate perspective. So we started an experiment. We had four students join us. It was spring 2020 semester. So we started in person. Honestly, I had no idea what to expect. And what happened is over the course of the next 3 months, it became so evident that this was very personal. And I had no idea that the students that had decided to join the independent study had their own experiences with immigration. And it kind of unfolded slowly. We were talking about things like, how do you do transcriptions? How do you do qualitative research? It was very basic research skills. And by the end of the time together, really by month three, each of them had divulged that they had a personal experience, and we had no idea. And they were like stones dropping, you know, like they'd drop a comment, and me and the other graduate student would look at each other and be like, oh my gosh, this is very, very deeply personal. So what happened that semester, as we all might remember, is the pandemic shutdown happened.
Yep.
And we moved everything online, and we finished the semester. And three of the four students asked to continue another semester with us. And so we got flexible. And we thought, you know, we're all home, we're all isolated, let's figure out a way to continue to involve those students. And Eric and I had been working together also separately. And at that point, I was able to bring Eric on board to lead this work with undergraduates. So Eric kind of spearheaded this very flexible strategy that we developed to involve undergraduates for the following, what do we do, 2 years with Eric, and we've done one more year since, as Eric trained other graduate students to evolve, to get involved. So Eric, you want to tell a little bit about how you adapted to our different undergraduates, because it was pretty fluid and interesting.
Yeah, it was, I think the idea that came to mind was, okay, we're still kind of doing a research approach. So how do we engage students in research and just present it, this, you know, this project as an opportunity for them to learn more about research. And then, like Joanna said, it turned out to be way more personal. So then we started kind of like shifting to doing a lot of things based on their needs and based on what they wanted to do. And they wanted to talk more about, you know, analyze the female perspective, because we had a lot of women in our group, and others wanted to talk about family tensions, and it just became the personal aspect could not be separated. So we just decided to, okay, hold on a little bit on the methods outcome, what we want to measure as a methods kind of course, instead letting them do a lot more reflection and a lot more process, and let's kind of all engage together collectively in a conversation about immigration. This is also an opportunity that needs to take place in multiple venues. So we just kind of use that opportunity. And it was very slow, I think, at the beginning, but it allowed for us to be flexible each time just to see what came up, and we kind of accommodated based on what was coming up each session.
Right.
And I think we kind of just drew it that way. We kind of plan as we went instead of having an objective kind of in mind. We just kind of plan, okay, next week, this is what came up this week. So next week, we're going to try to mold it here and keep it here and see what comes up. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of our approach.
Yeah. And, you know, go ahead, Joanna. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, so it went from four students that first semester. We've involved 28 students. It's a lot of people who've been interested. And each semester, so we had a group we would do, we call them the first semester groups. asked them to come up with team names. Remember, one of them had, one of their team names was Chicken Nuggets. I remember that now. I don't know why. And then they'd have second semester. We'd have a second semester, like students who'd been on the project. So we would give them different, different tasks based on how long they'd been involved. So we did things from the discussions. We added some readings to the literature. But as Eric mentioned, it became so generative. And Eric and I had a conversation that first summer, which was, oh my gosh, we're kind of doing Freirean pedagogy. We didn't, you know, we had both been trained and didn't even talk about that before, but yeah. It kind of this natural unfolding that is really, let's start where the students are at and let's learn from them. And so I think that back and forth happened organically, but we both come to education with that perspective.
That's great. And that's actually exactly what I was going to kind of get at when I interrupted you. And I'm glad that you said it. But like, I'll just kind of recap that by saying that it seems like the flexibility both that you were afforded as a result of the crazy time that we're all going through with COVID and the shut and the lockdown, along with your desire and ability and perhaps like some unconscious, you know, trickling in of what you were just talking about, you were able to create a program that was very flexible. And it's really interesting because, Eric, you mentioned the entry point was kind of, let's have these undergrads learn more about research, but it kind of went in a different direction, which I think is a really interesting entry point probably into the research that eventually came after it. And I guess like what I'm getting at here is just the ability to have a structure in place, but also pivot when you need to. And it sounds like, again, you had the affordance to be able to do that. Is just a great way to go about creating this. And clearly it's resonated. I was going to ask you, my next question was going to be about, sort of asking you, how did you create an inclusive and supportive learning environment, which you can add more to, but I feel like you've kind of answered that question by catering to the specific needs of those students as you went forward. So I want to, and feel free to like revisit that if there's other pieces that you want to get to, but I want to sort of shift gears to these students and how the study experience contributed to their understanding of immigration issues and their own identities, which is something that, Joanna, we talked about a lot with the students that we brought in for the podcast that we did before. Can you share any sort of specific examples or instances where students' perspectives or attitudes were positively influenced by their participation in the program?
Yeah. And I want to say, what do we do to kind of get people to feel comfortable? And Eric will have more to say because he's really the creative genius behind this. But before the shutdown for my research, I went to some youth groups to try to find people to interview. And they did this exercise called the highs and lows of the week. I think since COVID, we've now all participated in very similar things.
Yeah.
What do they call it? The rows or whatever. But we started all of our sessions with the highs and lows of the week. And they were often really light. I had a pumpkin spice latte this morning, or so they could be very silly, but other people shared some much deeper experiences. In fact, this past semester, I learned about all the flooding in Brooklyn when there was a big storm. Was it a month ago? Because a student said, my low is that my mom called me last night and our apartment is being flooded. So it kind of got at some other things. And I think that space really opened up a space where we were all on equal footings. And one thing, as the professor, I'm listed on all of the forms as the professor in charge of this. And I was really concerned about, or really wanting to develop an atmosphere where I was not the professor and students were trying to perform for the professor.
Yeah,
so one
yeah.
thing we were able to do is make the experience pass-fail. So there were no grades. It was pass-fail, do the work. We weren't evaluating. We were providing feedback. That was very, very important. And the other thing is that I did not lead many of these exercises. Eric's did. And Eric came up with some other great examples. And I have a comment about your second part about some of the things people have learned, but maybe I'll come back to that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, just to kind of take up from where Joanna left it, is We made it really intentional to connect with each other. And it started out with, just like Joanna said, it started out light. But every time we kind of increased how intentional and personal we got. We went from, you know, share your favorite song, or, you know, share what song you've been listening to lately and why are you listening to it, to more personal questions like what is something that you're holding, you know, inside you right now, mm-hmm. that it's like worrying you. So it became a space to connect and to allow others to allow people to share about their lives and about some of the challenges that they were going through. You know, especially during the pandemic, everyone felt alone. Everybody felt disconnected, and it became a space for connection. It became a space that people kind of look forward to, including myself. It became a space where I would be seen in a similar way, not in a, you know, professor leading the discussion. And it was clear that the students felt comfortable in that environment when they began sharing more and more and more, and then connecting it to some of the readings of interviews that we were doing. So a lot of our team building and icebreakers were really important, and those started early, and they just kind of built up where it became normal to kind of do all these activities that allowed us to connect beyond the work. And it was kind of, I intentionally made it so that it was kind of a light transition between the content that we were going to discuss from the interviews and from the data that we were looking at to the activities and vice versa, so that it was not this harsh switch, but rather kind of paved the way to the content that we were going to discuss.
Yeah. So, I mean, go ahead, Joanna.
Yeah. So one of the content pieces that students every semester have been so, that resonated so deeply was this concept of silence. And that's something I'm writing about in the book that's from the study. But students shared that they had not had a place to talk about immigration issues. Yeah. Until this moment. And so I'll never forget the student this semester who shared. We have a student this semester. I believe the student is a second year, but relatively young, in high school, not that long ago. And shared this semester that they had not thought that they could share their story about immigration with anybody before this. And to me, that as an educator is a shock moment. How come people aren't talking about this earlier? So we would read transcripts where people also said that in interviews, and then talk about how come, you know, why do you think you didn't feel, you know, why do you think this person didn't feel comfortable? And then ask the students who are there, did you feel comfortable? Did you share your story? Right. Why not? What is that silence about? And that's one of the nuggets that we've spent a lot of time talking about and unpacking.
Yeah. And that's kind of like, so I want to learn more. And I think I'm guessing the audience does too. Just thinking about, like, I'm looking at this as kind of what you just described, Joanna, which is a student opens up largely because of what Eric was talking about, these activities that allow them to kind of gradually become comfortable with one another so they can share these deeply personal stories and break the silence that you just talked about, Joanna. But a big part of this as well, and I think this is what we need to kind of explain to the people listening, is you mentioned reading these interviews and looking at the data. What does that look like? Paint a picture of that, like, you know, on a day-to-day basis, how does that work?
So we, Joanna had started doing interviews for the project. So we had a set of collected interviews, and we had students from the very first group transcribe some of the interviews. So then we had a set of, I can't remember what we started with, 10 or so interviews. And then we would share you know, some of those interviews, transcribed the interviews, so the students weren't listening to the voices, you know, in order to protect confidentiality and so on. So they were just reading transcriptions of this, of the interviews. And we would say, you know, Edwin will be the first interview you read, and you come to the discussion with having read the interview, and then we begin talking about what was in the interview, what captivated you, what did you find that was really interesting, or are there questions that you would have asked differently, or things like that, that would just open up conversation and allowed us to dive into the content. And so this is where some of the silencing conversations came up, when gendered loaded activities or descriptions were talked through, and we needed to unpack, where racial instances we needed to discuss, or immigration impacted experiences, trauma, and so that's where some of those things came up, and we spent a lot of time in each of those kind of themes, you know, unpacking them as much as we could and understanding why these were happening, and then allowing them to make it as personal as they could. Some of them allowed to share some of their personal experience within their families, with someone in their community that they were close to, with a friend. And that also gave us a different perspective, I think, in the grander picture of immigration enforcement in general, which is sort of some of the things that we were trying to capture in this project.
Yeah, so Eric, also as you're leading these discussions, or excuse me, as he was leading these discussions, did some really awesome things on Blackboard using whiteboards and sticky notes, which is really what we call coding as a research method. So I think that even though we started where people were, we were still developing those research skills and connecting the dots to, okay, this is what we do. And I think it was very important that students looked at the raw data. It's not digested, it's not interpreted, and they felt that they could participate and make suggestions. For me, as someone who does interviews, it was a little embarrassing times, you know. I kind of try to play it off and be like, well, but you know, they're listening to me have a conversation, and in a way can judge whether or not, you know, I did it in a way that seemed reasonable. Did I miss something? You know, and I'm not their age group. So I said to everybody, you know, I'd like to know, did I interpret something wrong? Do you think I asked the wrong question? I try to be very transparent about that. And I think that led to that feeling of community around the topics. And the other thing I would say, as students read these raw transcripts, we were very intentional about which ones we chose and selected. So the project aimed to talk to people who had some pretty traumatic experiences, an immigration raid in a childhood home, the deportation of a father, an arrest, being stopped in a car by police when you're little, and they're arresting your parents in front of you. So we actually tried not to do too many of these very traumatic stories. We did one maybe of those transcripts. And in general, we tried to, so we hit them with one of these very traumatic stories. But then we intentionally selected other stories that were lighter. Some people who said, immigration policies haven't affected me at all. And then as you read along, you're like, wait a minute, but you're saying that there's an uncle that you don't know because they're in Jamaica and you don't know why. And, you know, so we would sort of get at the silencing in that way too. Sure. And I think that was very important. So students could also help contribute to like figuring out how these layers of not talking about things, you could see them in this, as we call it, raw data transcripts, and then how you move from that to interpretation, to analysis, to what you would actually write about as a social scientist.
And I think something else to add here that it's really important is that in this process, an example of easing the kind of power dynamics that are always evident between professors and students, was, us suggesting, and with the undergraduate students suggesting questions that Joanna could follow up on and saying, actually, you missed an opportunity there. You know, like you could have asked this question. So Joanna would take those questions so that the next interview, she could potentially ask further questions or follow up questions that were more intentional, thinking through the lens of students, right, who may have experienced this, or just because of the, we always kind of joked about this, that Joanna and I were a little bit older, so they were kind of our lenses to it.
Yeah.
Younger generation.
Sure.
And they were able to provide some helpful, insightful points that I think were used later on. But more than that, I think it really established a group that knew that there wasn't someone above the other.
Yeah, it sounds to me like they were empowered to do the work but they were also supported and there was structure in place. And what I sort of keep coming back to in my mind here is like, I just start, what just jumped in was this idea of, you know, we talk a lot about, again, on the podcast with the K-12 students, we're talking about language acquisition, but also content, right? So like the gold standard is you're teaching both at the same time and they're both being, you know, equally treated in a way that you're going to learn the content, but also, but the language. What you're doing here is very similar to that, right? You're talking, you're establishing relationships, allowing people to feel like they can share, empowering them through the lens of research, but a very sort of, to me, a very sort of soft and approachable level of research, while also making sure that they are going to be given the opportunities and the desire maybe even to share their stories to the extent that they want to do it through looking at other people's stories. So I think it's like it's just a great combination of a lot of things at once to achieve a similar goal. There's not, don't seem to be a lot of silos here. And I don't know, everything seems to be connected. And I don't know if that was intentional at the very beginning or if it was a combination of, it is intentional, but we're also going to be really flexible to make sure that we get to where we want to go. It seems to be a little bit of both, but either way, I think it worked out really well.
Yeah, I don't think we set out to be as like outcome oriented. I think one of the things that we talked about as we were planning, especially the second time I did it, was to be our kind of objective was, let's create a space where we can normalize conversations about immigration. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of like the priority and allowing people to share their experiences. So we were kind of, our idea was like, it's like almost creating a community at UAlbany that allows for this space, and we should create more of these spaces. But that was kind of like the only goal, and we were just flexible moving it along.
You know, keep in mind that both Eric and I have taught immigration courses at UAlbany, and Eric, I'll let Eric speak for himself, but in my experience teaching immigration, I cannot get students in a regular classroom to be this open. I taught a class last spring, an honors class, so relatively better students. You know, we talk about immigration. I do a lot of personalization, similar style, because that's my teaching style. But I cannot, you know, I'll have one or two students who's like eager to share their own story and very reflective. But to have a space where everybody shares openly, it doesn't really happen. And I really do think there's something there. I've thought a lot about why. From my perspective, it's that a lot of students come to college and they want to leave the family stuff behind. They don't want to bring that with them necessarily. And for the students that I teach at UAlbany, that's at home and they're at school and they want to move away from that. And that is, I understand that. So in a normal classroom, I've always struggled to, you know, we'll have a few open conversations, but not in this way. There is something very special about being able to hear other people talk or through these transcripts, have somebody else talk about it. Yeah. Be like, huh, that's how I experience things. And then we talk about why, you know, why is it hard to do that? What was hard about it? And they really did push me to include, as Eric was saying, a couple things that I was not as aware of. And one was race. And those I asked in interviews to tell me about their primary school, their, you know, middle school, their high school, their friends. So I'm always asking about their background in interviews. So as you know, people would encourage me, the undergraduate students would encourage me to ask more about racial identities. Mm. They felt that was very important. There are a few stories of racialization experiences in K-12 in the transcripts that they felt were so parallel to their own experiences that they wanted me to ask more about race. And they also wanted me to ask more about ESL. Kind of yeah. Interesting, given this, they said ESL. First thing I learned is, wow, all these U.S. born kids were in ESL. I didn't really realize that.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that because that's not my background. So as I learn about this, a number of undergraduates said, you know, you should ask more because that's also a resource for students. So when I first started, oh, they're pulled out, they're you know, signaled within the school system as needing extra help. Perhaps mm-hmm. they did not like being in ESL, but a lot of students actually suggested that to them that was an important resource. And so I should ask more about ESL as being, you know, this beneficial resource where students did have support at earlier ages. It's right. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Great context that you just gave, Joanna, which is that, like, going back to what you originally said, I'm glad you said it, that in your sort of regular classes, these conversations just don't really happen. And you've obviously both created sort of a recipe for them to begin happening, right? And I want to get into in a minute, like, how we can get this to happen earlier. I'm glad you mentioned the ESL thing, or MLL or EL or EB, whatever yeah. acronym you want to use, and the sort of the support system there, and that. Also, I think being part of their, like, academic identity, for lack of a better term, like that's a label that they had, whether it's positive or negative, that's a part of their experience. But before we get into, like, how can we sort of recreate these things or start to do them earlier, because I think there's tremendous value in that. I want to talk a little bit more about, like, what have you observed? And I know this is relatively new, but, like, as you see students kind of go through this experience, how have their communication skills, maybe even their critical thinking abilities, improved or changed in some way? And particularly as it's related to this really complex stuff that they're dealing with, and sociopolitically, with their families, just in their everyday sort of identity. What changes or enhancements even have you seen in these students?
Well, I'm very excited. You know, some of the, as an educator, the most amazing thing you see is when students move on and kind of have awakening moments. So one of the things that we layered on and we were not planning on doing this was what we called a writing workshop. So we started more social science. We're doing some coding. We're doing some thinking, reflecting. And we realized that students wanted to, or some students could produce some really polished writing. And so we did a writing workshop one year, and I'm hoping actually to include some of those in this book that I'm writing, where students developed a reflective piece that we then polished and we workshopped among the other students working on that. So a more polished piece. So some of them are poems, some of them are stories, little stories. So we spent some time working on that. And it's really gratifying to see students. Like I said, I teach them in other classes. I teach them in a research methods, and the type of work that comes through is very different. So to see something that feels to me that it's totally publishable is exciting. And the other thing that is very exciting is the career choices that students make. So it's been in a few years now. So students who've graduated from UAlbany are still in touch. And, you know, one of the students was getting ready for graduation. We're like, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to work at this hotel, and then I get to travel. I'll get free hotel miles. Well, I just wrote a letter for an MSW program, letter of recommendation, because that student decided instead to work for a nonprofit that works with victims of domestic violence, and was so inspired that wants to go to graduate school in social welfare.
Amazing.
And so it's not the only student. We have a few stories like that. And so mm-hmm. seeing that kind of development and this appreciation, I guess, for other people's lives is really special to me as an educator, because that's what I want to do with my work.
I think I would add that we really focused on growth. So even from seeing a first reflection paper that they wrote to seeing, we allowed them to keep going back to it and working on it instead of, here's your grade for this, for this one paper. They could come back to it and keep working on it and keep working on it and keep working on it. Until they felt comfortable in sharing it and consider that their final assignment, if you will. So I think that also allowed for people to understand that it's not just a one trial type of thing, that you could keep growing, that you could keep going. And, you know, seeing their strengths shine through. So I remember a student that was like, I do better with numbers. Someone that was like a math study or math major and really participated, and then, you know, saying I could do better with numbers. And then we partner her with a graduate student that was doing more quant stuff background, mm-hmm. and you know, help develop something, and then they did charts and did their own kind of research based on kind of their needs. So I think allowing them to find what they were passionate about, or allowing them to see, oh, I can contribute in this way, and letting them run with that was really satisfying to see. And it was also a medium for us to see their growth. Right now, like, we're going to test you on this thing. We're not going to test you about immigration policies and that's it. Like, which ones do exist? Instead, it was more about letting them see what they can contribute to the project and to their own growth.
Right. And so I just jotted down a bunch of words while I was looking down because I want to transition into kind of how we can expand this kind of work, which I know that you're, is something that you both are thinking of. And I want to, through our lens, and most of the people listening to this are K-12 people, so I want to kind of transition there. But beforehand, let me just sort of read in no particular order the words that I jotted down. Relationships, community, personalization, teachable moments, reflection, assessment, formative and summative, growth. There's probably a million more I could write down. But all those words, anybody who's listening knows that those are key things, and really every level of education, right? Like, we want to be doing those things for our students. We want to be developing the relationships, creating communities, personalizing learning, taking advantage of these teachable moments, even though if we didn't know that they were going to come up. All the things that you all have done through so masterfully over the last few years. And so transitioning into that, like, these are things that all good teachers do and that they want to do. So what are potential sort of opportunities and maybe even some challenges in creating, we could call them similar programs, but even like moments or times where we can do this in the K-12 setting that you kind of highlighted in your own experience or research? Are there spaces that educators can and should be creating to allow for this kind of inclusivity, to allow for this kind of vulnerability, to empower students to talk about these things? Or is it something that on the other side is something that should be done just really at the university level when students, as you said, sort of join up, like leave home and they have maybe an opportunity to reflect? What are your thoughts on that?
I have a couple of thoughts. So the first thing and is the following. In the university level, often the students that get this kind of personalized experience, some of those keywords you talked about, tend to be students who are on paper already really good students.
And I can see that.
Yeah, right? It seems very familiar.
They're seeking it out, yeah.
They're seeking it out. They ask a specific question. They're really good students. They have their, you know, a professor sees their grades. They're like, oh, I'll involve them in research. What we did, we didn't do that. And in fact, a lot of the students that, I mean, I would describe, I looked over their transcripts before we involved them, but we didn't do a great GPA cutoff. We we kind of had a lot of students were really more like B's and C level students, and it was so transformative. So the reason why I want to share that is I think that is something that K-12 is more sensitive to, of not providing those special opportunities. Maybe this is my idealization. I don't know. You're all experts, those listeners out there. But in my experience, you know, at college level, we tend not to do these personal things except with an elite group that already seeks it out. And I think the K-12 experience, it can bring that to, it has that great potential and opportunity. And again, you would all be experts, but I think about this again and again. Every time I go to a parent-teacher conference, I'm a parent, so I was just at my parent-teacher conferences. I'm like, gosh, it's really not all that different, higher ed and K-12.
Yeah.
Pedagogy is different, but the structures, the constraints are similar. So, you know, our constraints at the higher ed level is I have a class. I had to create an independent study. I have other courses I'm supposed to be teaching. There's like all these structures and metrics that I have to fulfill. And it's really, really hard when you have those structures from administrators to create this alternative space. And I was very fortunate. I had some funding for this research project. So we were kind of able to create this space with Eric and other graduate students help to make it happen. But I would imagine that's a parallel with K-12 where you're constrained. You got to teach this curriculum. You got to teach this stuff. So how do you make space for those moments? It's hard. And I think that's a parallel.
And I think just not to interrupt, but I think these things happen. I think they do happen, right? In let's say high school where I taught and where I could consider myself an expert. They happen, but they happen sort of accidentally and these happy teachable moments.
Yeah.
And they're so like, they resonate so much with both the teacher and the student. But I don't know of too many places where there's kind of a formal structure where you can do this. And I'm sure that there are a lot of constraints. I mean, in the sociopolitical landscape that we're living, there are certainly places where you probably wouldn't even be allowed to do something like this, unfortunately. I don't think that's the norm right now, but there certainly exists. So anyway, I just wanted to add a little bit of texture there. Sorry to interrupt.
But that's exactly where I'm going. Like, I'm not a K-12, so I'm like, I don't know how you could create this space for this. But what I can say is I think, I do think that one doesn't, what we learned is intentionally talking about it too specific and too head on doesn't really work.
Yeah.
And the way we did it is kind of the side, you know, we're doing some research skills where, you know, you kind of side into it. And
it's storytelling in a lot of ways. Like you're learning about people's stories and they're people that have walked the same kind of path in life as you, or you may even know who they are in some instances.
Yeah. And so some of the students that participated in this independent study never shared their story. You know, we're saying, oh, some of them did, but a few of them I happen to know because maybe they told me and didn't share with a group that they had some very parallel experiences. They didn't feel like going there. And you know what? That's fine.
Right.
Right. And I think that's actually really important for K-12. Because when people are younger, if they have had experience with immigration enforcement that's particularly traumatic, they may not be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And it's not our job to get them to talk about it. That's not the point. The point is to have it be open so it doesn't feel so awful inside, you know, even if you don't share it. So I think that's where we could go in K-12 spaces is being more open about this migratory experience. And people don't have to share. The benefits will come later anyway, because they grew up in a place where it wasn't the secret.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, my gut here is thinking that these kinds of things would have to happen sort of alongside counseling at schools, because you're dealing with trauma in many of these cases. And so it's fairly complicated. But it's just, it seems like it's so worthwhile. Eric, do you have anything to add there? You've been kind of left out. I've been.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks for asking that question. Obviously we know that there's a lot of barriers in doing something like this in K-12. But I think there's a lot more, I guess, newer scholarship on schooling. that allows us some insight into how this potentially looks. And I think thinking about opportunities to create spaces along curricula that exist, right? Intentionally normalizing conversations that many people feel are contentious or divisive. And I think they go alongside the content that is aimed in the school or the goals or the objective of each teacher. But it has to be allowed that students are bringing these ups, you know. For instance, some of the current conversations around critical race theory, inclusivity in general, are topics that adults are having a conversation about it, but often we leave students out of those conversations.
Great point.
And I think if we are more intentionally allowing students to lead some of those conversations, we would have more inclusive spaces in K-12 and more opportunities for, you know, some of these moments that are educational. We have to create more opportunities for these moments to be created, and they happen by being youth-led. And we can think back about, you know, YPAR, Youth Participatory Action Research, and, you know, youth organizing that has been done in schools and out of schools. In my research, I follow young people that are out of school, that they're dropped out, they're pushed out of schools. And I follow some young people around, and some of the things that they do are things that they can kind of learn from school. They do vigils and they do organized skating events as a protest to something. But they put to work some of the skills that they've learned in an educational environment. Mm-hmm. So I say that because there were moments in their educational experience that allow them to gain those skills, allow them to be critical about a topic, and empower them to do something about it, even though now they're no longer in school,
right,
for various reasons. But I think the youth action, the youth center aspect of education is often left out. And I think we need to go back to that, right? You mentioned storytelling, and, you know, for centuries, storytelling is such a powerful educational tool, but we're doing it from the top down instead of allowing young people to be the leaders in narrating some of those stories that are happening in their classrooms. And I think that's an important thing that we've missed an opportunity educationally and structurally. And I think we need to revisit that.
Really a great point. And I do think, again, like the things that you're talking about are happening, but they're not happening at scale, right? There's no sort of formal opportunities to make those happen. And a lot of what you talk about, we hear all the time, this idea of taking an asset-based approach when working with multilingual learners. And it's this like nebulous term that we hear all the time. There is a great example of how you do that. You know that these students are bringing experiences with them that are assets to themselves and those around them. And when you open it up, to kind of experience those, you're going to create, you're going to empower students. And the other thing I was thinking about, and then we'll kind of wrap it up with my last two questions, is how amazing would it be for you all if you had students who experienced all this before they came to you? Like, how much more you're doing amazing things, but how much more could you do? And how could those students sort of mentor other younger students? I mean, it's such a lot to think about here. And there are about five questions that I wanted to ask you that we didn't get to. But Joanna, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of follow up on what I just said, because Eric and I were just talking for a bit.
Well, yeah, and I think Eric and you hit it on really such an important point, which is that letting students have the space to lead is so important. And coming back to that issue of trauma, you know, I've been now rereading a bunch of the stories that I collected in interviews, thinking about the young people that I interviewed who actually did have space to deal with some of that earlier, went before. And I've learned a lot from that. And what I've learned is that there are definitely some young people who were participating in youth groups or had a mentor or teacher or someone they confessed their issue, you know, what was happening in their family too, to someone at school. I have a handful of stories like that. One of them was quite simply a coach at track practice, and said, I just couldn't run that day. And the coach, I told the coach, I started crying. The coach noticed something was off. I started crying. Coach said, what's going on? I told the coach, and he was like, okay, go do some sprints. But that moment was, it was so important to the student that an adult listened. And I think that letting students have the space to come to educators and share that, I mean, that's really what is key, is letting them come and look for that if they want it. And it's totally doable at earlier ages. And I think such a resource that K-12 teachers can be there if needed.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, what in a situation like that, what students need is to know that they can go to, that they have someone, preferably multiple people. And for some students, it's going to be the track coach. And for other people, it's going to be the math teacher. And for other people, it's going to be the counselor. For other people, it might be the person who works in the cafeteria. It doesn't matter. It's a community. Exactly. It's a village that is created where we have more people to rely on, especially now with all of the research showing this isolation and this loneliness and how that's really impactful on people's lives. And if you're carrying around those kinds of stories and you don't have a community, it's kind of double the harm that's being done. Okay, so let me just I'm going to sort of promote Impact quickly, because Joanna, we're going to do something there, and that's happening. We'll link to it so that people know, because we're going to have to come back and talk more about this, because we didn't get to everything I wanted to get to. But I think you provided us with a really, really good sort of example of some important work that's being done, and perhaps some ideas. Those of you listening, and both Joanna and Eric, you mentioned they're experts that are doing the work they're doing. Maybe you have some ideas that you can apply to this. If you do, would love to hear about them. You can check out our Facebook page, the Elevation Educators Group, maybe get a conversation going there, or we'll see an impact. I want to wrap it up with two questions. One is, how can people learn more about the work you're doing? What's the best way to reach out?
We do have a website, but rather than give you that, the best way to reach out is to email me, jdreby at albany.edu. And I can get back to you with links to some of the research if you're more interested in the research aspect of what we've done, the website, or some of the pedagogical approach, which you also have a paper on. I think you can reach out to Eric too at
emacias at american.edu. And I could also offer links and other important articles, or answer any questions that come up.
Great. And if you're driving right now, or you're doing the dishes, or you're out for a walk, don't worry about jotting that down. We'll put it on the show notes as well as the accompanying blog post for this episode, along with some other links for you to look at. So one last question that I ask everyone. I know that you're not happy that I limited you both to one, and I'm sorry, but could you each let us know if there's a book or film or any other resource that's had an important influence on you, either personally, professionally, that you'd recommend to listeners? Joanna, I know you said you had one at the beginning, so I'm going to have you start.
I get to go first in case it's not the same one. So I actually don't read a ton of, like memoir type stuff about immigration, because it's like work, right? Like I don't read all this stuff on work, but made an exception this past year. I read Solito. I don't know how many of you've read Solito, but hands down, amazing book. As someone who's interviewed children in immigrant families for my career for 20 years, I've talked to children in these kinds of experiences. That book was amazing. And I think the reason why it resonates so deeply is it's a story, you know, he's telling a story. We talk a lot about storytelling, but it's a story of reclaiming that story a bit later in life. So he tells the story of his crossing from Central America through Mexico and to the States. It's a very short period of time, but he's recounting, you know, he's going back and remembering. So it's got all these layers of memory to it and the traumas of it. and it's so beautifully written. So if you have not read this book, maybe many of the listeners already have, but that book to me was about storytelling, about uncovering silences that are in your own brain about your experiences, and actually really resonated with the work I've been doing, even though I've been talking to a lot of people who are US born who've not had those journeys. There was something about the way he went back through, thought about his childhood, and recountered those memories that was very special and amazing. So props out to Solito.
Great. So Solito, Eric, I saw you give a sort of big thumbs up for that one. So maybe you were going to choose that, but if you were going to, now you're going to choose another one.
This is really hard. and Solito is a fantastic memoir that, I've now read it a couple of times and it's so good. But actually, I think professionally, so I'll stick to the professional lens. I will say there is this fantastic book, Everyday Legal by Joanna Drebbe, that was insightful for me in many different ways. I think that her writing is brilliant. And it allows for a read of all these systems kind of working against families and like kind of family dynamics as well. And that the stories, the way that she captures the family stories as well as her own in it's a very powerful way of doing it. So I really look at her work as kind of a North Star. It's like I want to write my book using kind of her approach. And it's no reason why I consider Joanna, you know, an amazing mentor. I would choose her book, Everyday Legal. If you haven't read it, please do.
I love that. And I happen to know the author, and the author just gave her email out to everybody about 5 minutes ago. So you can not only read the book, but you can actually reach out to the author of this prolific book and get some information. And with that, and this is a great like transition into, I'm so lucky that I get to do this work because I get to meet folks like you who are not only doing great work, but so happy and excited to share what you're doing. And I really hope people take advantage of not only the episode, but reading the blog post, joining us for Impact, and reaching out to you if they have any questions, because I know for a fact, collaborating with you both, you're very generous with your time. But that's because you're very passionate about this work. And I think if we can bring together higher ed and K-12 and bridge research with practice, we're going to win. And that's I think a big thing. So thank you so much, both of you, for joining us on Highest Aspirations. And we'll have to find a time to reconnect, because I think there's a lot of stones that we did not turn over.
Thank you so much for having us, Steve. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.